You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, Radio Albion, the Orthodox Nationalist on WordPress.com. And this is being recorded on Sunday, the 25th, even though you're not listening to this until Wednesday or afterwards. And if there's anything in the topic we're going to talk about today, of course, the events in Russia. If anything changes between now and Wednesday, when you're listening to this, I will cover it on Thursday. As always, I appeal to assist Sven Longshanks while he is in prison, as well as myself. Some of the analysis that I give, whether it be on this topic or anything else, is completely independent, and that's made possible because of you. Of course, we're going to be talking about the Wagner affair. And the coup is a bad name, but it doesn't make sense. But the semi-rebellion of Eugene Prigozhin, or Yevgeny, ultimately with much to do about nothing, but it is worth discussing. I don't have to tell you that the media will talk about that in a minute. In the West, they started making things up. Same thing for the White House. Making stuff up that they have absolutely just, you know, whatever they think should be, they will describe to you. Johnson's Law being what it is, it's very difficult to contradict them, at least in any kind of public capacity. So I want to do a few things here. I want to discuss a little bit what a PNC is, or the private military company, corporation, get involved in the events of what's happening, the interpretation of not only the events, but consequences, and then possibly give a motive for this man. The word coup doesn't make sense, attempt or otherwise. I think limited symbolic rebellion may be the best way to put it. So, PNCs, private military companies. This is a post-World War II phenomenon. They are mercenaries. Not all of them deal with combat operations, but some of them, Wagner, does. In the oligarchic republics of North Italy in the Renaissance, standing armies were largely banned. That's all they needed was a popular general to overthrow their charade. No, they relied on a very early version of the private military company. But it is a completely capitalist phenomenon. It's a privatization of warfare as a means of expanding the range of the regime's control over the world without implicating the government or even the private sector that pays it. This has also been largely a British and American phenomenon, especially early on. An early one was the British Kini-Mini services. They trained elite forces during the Sri Lankan Civil War. And of course, they also have even the subsidiary Saladin security, part of training the Afghan Mujahideen, coming like the Vanel Corporation and Pacific Architects and Engineers. They were largely engaged in construction and maintenance of military facilities run by NATO. But they really didn't come into their own as far as public knowledge, really until the invasion of Iraq. And we all know who Blackwater is, which is run by Eric Prince. And it made the PMC more or less a household name. Blackwater received its first contract in 2001. The Blackwater Security Consulting, largely guarding CIA agents, building this intelligence network to, quote-unquote, eliminate al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, end quote. And that really sparked the rise of this industry. Blackwater subcontracted out to DynCorp, protecting diplomatic missions. But as we all know, remember 2004, four Blackwater soldiers, I guess you can call them, were killed by rebels in the city of Fallujah. And that's the origin of Vigilant Resolve, the punitive operation. In that case, they took full responsibility, despite that being a private company. 2004, they received a two-year contract to protect diplomatic missions, Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and even Israel, guarding the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. And they have been, because they aren't fully under the control of the state. They're involved in fact, the initiator of armed clashes. 2007 is quite infamous in this regard. Employees of this company, Blackwater, DynCorp, whatever, were guarding a diplomatic convoy from the State Department and staged a shootout in Baghdad, which 17 Iraqi civilians were killed. But no matter how many times they may reorganize, they are sued. Reputation costs have suffered over the years. Even Eric Prince resigned as CEO at some point. But it didn't matter because he just organized other PMCs located outside of the U.S. So there was a merger, you know, Triple Canopy, Academy, formerly Blackwater, other companies came under Constellus Holdings. And that they were bought later on by Apollo. So this is kind of what they do. Smaller, the Arab sheikdoms, like the United Arab Emirates, have used them substantially. They also fought, you know, pirates in Somalia. This is, you know, they span the border between public and private. These are certainly for-profit companies, and there's plenty of work for them. UAE, years ago, gave a $529 million contract through Reflex Responses, R2, supplying 800 mercenaries to defend against quote-unquote Iranian terrorism. So, the market is expanding. There's about 3,000 of them today, and estimates seem to between 900,000 and a million men under arms in one capacity or another. But just in 2006, there was only 150. PMCs are now a normal part of warfare, and outside of academia, there's only a handful of articles or analyses of these. PMC, Mozart, the U.S., Andrew Milburn's from the Marine Corps, a colonel, is involved directly with the Ukrainian war. Mozart provided all kinds of, you know, fire support, drones, mine clearing, etc. Same thing for British intelligence. They hired Prevail Partners, really for the same reason. But we're talking about Wagner. And we have to be careful here. It's worth noting that it has been very successful. The capture of Soledar, successful advancement in Bakhmut. And, in fact, Wagner's been participating in this since 2014. Some of the success later on from the new Russia was because of these companies. But this is a non-state actor, but it is a part of a network, the so-called network-centric wars, the unification of all participants under or within a single grid. And international law is sparse on how they function. So this is an ongoing problem, and that governments, especially the U.S., doesn't have a draft, supplements their forces with private military companies. Now we have Yevgeny Prigozhin. who really amounted to nothing. It's hard to take him seriously when he says these events are part of some sort of patriotic resistance. But there's been this trolling war between him and, of course, the Ministry of Defense. He published a brief letter to President Putin and Gerasimov, chief of the general staff, threatening, in fact, and he wrote this back in May, threatening to withdraw his men from Artemovsk due to what he called an absence of ammunition. He used the phrase paramilitary bureaucrats, as my friend Andrew Kubiko has stated, and in fact requested that his forces be replaced by regulars. Now, this has been going on for some time, but it never really interfered with anything until now. And I want to say just the last 24 hours, Russia has beat back these purely symbolic actions of the Ukrainian military, such as it is. So it hasn't affected anything in that respect. But this is what I wake up to on Saturday morning, and so many of the people contacting me were just hysterical. That a civil war is brewing. The nonsense coming from the press has been deafening. But the details here, which is now as I'm saying this, the deal has been reached with Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus. But there's still an investigation going on. Andrew Kubiko and myself, I mean, independently. Talked about the nature of private armies in the era of Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth, the creation of the Oprichnina, which was a public state, that was, you know, under the Tsar himself, against the private armies of the boyar class. Then and now, you have the claim that whatever setbacks occur, they occur due to elite subversion, whether it be incompetence or corruption. Prigozhin pretended to be patriotic. And of course, the innuendo of the whole thing is that there are traitors in your midst. In this case, he is running he's on the board of a private army. So it's the reverse of what happened in, under Ivan. But they can get so strong that the central government has a tough time getting rid of them. And that was the case with the Oprichnina. I thought maybe, yesterday when I first heard about this, that this was going to affect, obviously the Western capitals thought this was wonderful. They have no idea what's going on. And so the Ukrainian, whatever's left of them, wants to recapture Artemovsk. I thought maybe they had a chance of going back into the city, Bakhmut. But clearly it's had no effect on the battlefield. Let me quote from Kubikov. I'm sorry, I said Kubiko. It's Kubikov. He says, many non-Russian and non-Russian pro-Russian, the alternative media might have sympathized with Prigozhin's harsh criticisms of the special operations after Russia's setbacks last year, Kharkov, Kherson regions, not to mention the grinding battle of Artemovsk. That's no excuse for what he did. Prigozhin could have operated within the law to push through his envisaged reforms via Wagner's nationwide Second Front media campaign that he initiated a month ago, but he chose force instead. Not too long after this, you know, very minor set of events occurred, but the most they did was take over a military base on Rostov, not too far from the Ukrainian border. But Putin was decisive. He called on, of course, the immediate cease and desist, called them anti-state criminal activities, taking up arms against their comrades, which is all true. The fact that this was done in the midst of this war, not only in the midst of this war, but on the cusp of absolute total victory, where you even have Western generals and politicians saying maybe this is time to wrap this up. But before I go any further, I want to talk about Prigozhin. Many have asked if he is Jewish. The answer is yes, he is. Mostly on his father's side, not sure about his mother. Keep in mind, he is not a military man. In the Soviet era, he was in and out of prison. In fact, it was the Times of Israel that I found that he was, in fact, Jewish, considered Jewish. One of his backers is Sergei Kirilenko, whose real name is Israel, former deputy chief of staff, behind him in this, also Jewish. Prigozhin is a financier of Wagner, maybe one of the founders, but the military head was Dmitry Utkin. Going back to 1979, Prigozhin was initially given a very minor sentence for theft. A few years later, again, but because of so much of what he did in the meantime, he was accused of robbery, fraud, and even corruption of minors, and was sentenced to 12 years. They were robbing upscale neighborhoods, which I didn't realize they had in the Soviet Union. Being ironic about it, they pardoned him in 1988. And Prigozhin, after 1990, took advantage of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of Russia, and built an empire for himself. Grocery stores, restaurants, in fact, the first grocery store chain, Contrast, which, of course, he ran with Boris Spector. Spector's also a Jewish name. He was involved in gambling. He was the CEO of Spectrum, one of the first casinos in St. Petersburg. Can you imagine the 1990s Russia having these casinos? It's completely amoral. But in the midst of decay, Prigozhin and his fellow Jews did very well. He runs a restaurant chain and is reported to have a yacht and just billions of rubles floating around. And I think the fact that he is not a military man, that he doesn't know much about strategy and everything else, that he is an arrogant man, has a lot to do with what's happening here. Again, the Wagner Defense Ministry battle is nothing new, but the accusation that Prigozhin made is that the war has been poorly handled and that more aggressive action is necessary. As I said, his main claim, though, was the Department of the Ministry of Defense and withheld ammunition. And it's a little strange, though, despite the Bakhmut battle was won, his whole story fell to pieces. But there is a law in Russia banning any criticism of the military, especially during warfare. But his motives. Now, let's face it, the U.S. has done this before. In the original Iraq War, 1990, senior Iraqi officers commanded elite troops, crucial forces, were bribed not to fight American forces. And the U.S. has fully admitted this. Had huge sums of money to various Iraqi generals and lower officers to not fight. We all know the casualty rate was much higher than anyone ever realized, but that has a lot to do with the sort of victory. I mean, it took two invasions to finally get rid of this man who has harmed nobody, as far as the U.S. is concerned. It was, in fact, General Tommy Franks. These Iraqi officers were promised almost their own private fiefdoms and just went with the highest bidder. And I say that because of the fairly obvious, by now, connection between Prigozhin and Western intelligence, possibly using the very same methods. So, the 23rd, 24th of this month, June, Prigozhin claimed that his units, and I put that in quotes, that they were being defeated. Now, we all know how ridiculous that is because they won. And so, the defense ministry says this is all nonsense. But this special military operation, the SMO, Wagner has been important from the very beginning. Early on, there were some minor setbacks, and it was so easy to go into a you know, emotional rant blaming anyone and everyone without really wondering whether, in fact, that actually happened that way. The way that these things tend to work in Russia right now is the aggressive stance comes from the Wagner Group, while the status quo comes from the defense ministry. Some people don't realize, you know, this is one of the PMCs that even has its own air force, armor and artillery. They were assigned initially to the Soledar-Bakhmut corridor. Last year it had been heavily fortified by the Ukrainians, the so-called meat grinder in this area, and that's what really put Wagner's reputation through the roof. Prigozhin took credit for a lot of things that he had nothing to do with. But let me quote, you know, an old standby, someone who's been very helpful, Scott Ritter. Here's what he says. Wagner achieved its well-deserved martial reputation largely because it was able to operate independent of the suffering bureaucracy of the Russian military. Thus liberated, Wagner was able to best exploit the experience and skill of its veteran fighters, streamlining command and control and tactical decision-making to enable Wagner to seize and maintain operational initiative, allowing Wagner to dominate the battlefield. While they had operational independence, it received its operational tasking from the Russian General Staff, which also provided Wagner with the weapons, ammunition, fuel, and other logistical sustainment necessary to carry out its mission. Many have pointed out that there is a, that was the end of the quote. Many have pointed out that private armies, of course, are illegal in most parts of the world, and Russia's no different. And Wagner was okay, so long as they worked in Syria and West Africa. But once the Donbass voted to become part of Russia, things changed. Even despite that, they were willing to look the other way. Something else Scott Ritter mentioned, this ammunition claim, and I've not heard this described any better here. When Wagner was nothing but a minor group of units in Russian life, as their reputation grew since 2014, so as this war began in 2022, Wagner was treated specially. They weren't under the same logistical and supply protocols as the rest of the army was. And they were used to pretty much getting anything they wanted. So once they were now operating essentially on Russian soil, that special treatment stopped. The quantities, especially in terms of artillery, were cut back, not, you know, to their harm, but this was the Russian norm, given the units of that size. However, the tactics that Wagner used were concentrated overwhelming fire, which takes a huge amount of ammunition. So denied those older quantities, and they were used to receiving this, their assault detachments began to take casualties, and this is where the public feud came from. Doesn't take a genius to realize that the pro-Ukrainian media information warfare got a hold of this long before this, you know, happened just in the last few days, and actually began spreading the rumor that Prigozhin was becoming a leader of the so-called opposition. And he fed off of it. Of course, he denied it, any kind of ambition, but he continued these rhetorical attacks on Shoigu and Gerasimov to the point where Putin had to intervene. The rhetoric got so bad. Prigozhin is not really a day-to-day part of the military operation. The guy owned a chain of restaurants. But there was a point where he actually went off the rails. These are histrionics. I actually believe he is a histrionic case. Threatening to pull Wagner out in the middle of a battle. And part of this was to make believe and to put out the image that he is a frontline commander. And he has all these pictures, many of them are not real, of him commanding forces. So this is an emotional delusion in Prigozhin's case. He isn't knowledgeable on military matters. So Western intelligence, though, became very interested in him. For Western intelligence to treat him like this military dissident, and I have no doubt that they really played into this with him, it wouldn't have taken much to get him to act in their interests. This grandiose sense of his own importance, the constant histrionic need for attention and to feel appreciated, he was the perfect guy to be recruited, let alone the financial issues. When Wagner was slowly brought under the ministry's control and the ammunition was regularized, he was goaded into the rhetoric, the really hysterical rhetoric that he was involved in, which at the time I kind of ignored. But after the Bakhmut meat grinder ended with the Russian victory, the PMC was withdrawn for a while. And the defense ministry had announced this period of time, isn't that long ago, that Wagner has to sign contracts with the state, bringing it more under state control. And let me quote Ritter again here. According to Prigozhin, Military Council of Commanders, the real leaders of Wagner, refused to allow these contracts to be signed. Wagner and Shoigu were heading for a confrontation. Wagner was, during this time, building upon the goodwill of the Russian people that had been earned in the bloody fighting for Bakhmut. Wagner was engaged in an unprecedented public relations campaign designed to imprint on the Russian people the heroic status of its fighters, all the while seeking to recruit new fighters into its ranks. The success of this PR campaign only reinforced in the mind of Prigozhin the notion that he and Wagner were more popular amongst the Russian people than were Shoigu, Gerasimov, and the Russian Ministry of Defense. There's no doubt in my mind that CIA Western intelligence is involved in this disaster. Disaster for him, I should say. The Ukrainian government, that is to say, the Americans via Ukraine, were hiring anti-Putin Russians wherever they can find them and sent them into the country, trying to spread the rumors of Russian incompetence. Prigozhin was more than happy to magnify all of this. And really the whole Russian patriot idea came from a whole bunch of Ukrainian telegram channels. The fact that they were able to do this with a pro-Russian nationalist bent made them all the more effective, at least in the minds of the agencies that were involved in this. This was an absurd insurrection. And many of his men were under the impression, by the way, when this happened on Saturday morning here in the U.S., that they were going to go reinforce the border region where they were not too long ago to keep any irregular force from penetrating into Russian territory. His goal, I think, is purely personal. But I do believe that he has histrionic personality disorder, and I do think, even more seriously than that, may be delusional, at least in the sense that he has no idea how to estimate his own importance. No one came to his cause at the time. Putin has never been more popular with saying something. He didn't have 25,000 men, as he wanted to say. I bet you he doesn't really know how many. It was a handful, and many of them didn't know what was going on. And this isn't to say that criticism of the SMO isn't occasionally warranted. But when someone like Prigozhin, I believe he was elected Trendsetter of the Year at the St. Petersburg International Forum in 2022, I firmly believe that that kind of attention really triggered his histrionics. And a number of people have made the claim that there were really, other than that, there were two other triggers: the contract issue and the possibility of Putin engaging in a political solution, so long as their security was guaranteed. I read Sergei Glazyev's telegram feed in Russian, and he went so far as to talk about the end of World War I for Russia, that Prigozhin's hissy fit was very similar to the chain of events that led to the Tsar's demise. Of course, now we could say that it was almost a meaningless set of events. But the so-called counteroffensive of Ukraine, which idiots who don't know what a counteroffensive is keep saying, the miserable failure of that continued to increase divisions in the Western world. Even feelers for peace from the West. Glazyev actually says that there may be a West Asian intelligence agency involved. West Asia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, I don't know. I doubt it's Turkey. Turkey came on the side of Russia immediately. Russia's winning on all fronts and in all areas. The timing sticks with me. But reality discredits this man. He was claiming to try to improve how this is being run, and yet victory was everywhere. Glazyev did talk about foreign intelligence as almost an obvious case. I tend to agree with him. But there's no doubt in my mind it was a spy agency or something like that that manipulated his personality disorders, heightened and agitated him in terms of his perceptions. The very fact that they knew that this man had mental problems, that he was histrionic, their psychological analysis would say he's the perfect guy. Prigozhin made up all kinds of stories that the defense ministry bombed the Wagner base, rocket attacks. None of that actually happened. But foreign intelligence agencies could have planted a lot of this. The messages and videos that he sent, a few social media networks, they're not real. And I had to do some digging to get really in the Russian press to get to the heart of this. They said this actually on the 22nd. He sent out a video allegedly showing a rocket strike in the rear camps by the forces of the defense ministry, and that was staged. That came from Russia's Channel 1. And there's three points that they make showing this is true. Number one, that there's no corroborating evidence anywhere. There's no other video, no other nothing. Number two, and this is more technical, is that the statements were distributed as audio messages. Same metadata, of course. In other words, they were all recorded at the same time and published using a delay. Number three, I would say it's about 10 minutes that had elapsed between the publication of the video of these so-called strikes and the alleged time of the strikes themselves. It's difficult to believe that they were able to get all the data and analyze it and do this video in that short period of time. Whether he had that capacity or whether his paymasters had that capacity, that's a separate issue. But I don't want this to make Wagner itself look bad. There's Wagner who, in Artemovsk, or Bakhmut, not that long ago, pinned down what's left of the Ukrainian infantry there, which is what allowed Russia to bring up its new reserves. That was one of the events that allowed for the present victory. It doesn't mean it wasn't treason. Of course it was treason. We all know the deal has been put out. Lukashenko is saying he has to leave the country, actually allegedly went to Belarus. He has to leave the country, and any criminal charges will be dropped. Again, I'll repeat the timing. At a time of the miserable humiliation of Ukraine, this so-called counteroffensive, this is when this happens? Of course, the so-called march on Moscow was a histrionic joke. He didn't have the men. Was it 800 miles from Rostov to Moscow? This is absolutely absurd. And of course, met with cheers in the West. I'll talk about the media here briefly in the West, and it was very hard for me to read. RT has been pretty good. But, when I say that they're inventing things, with Johnson's Law in mind, you know, I'm not exaggerating. They're just simply inventing things that never happen, and they are with no evidence that they happen, and claiming that they had evidence for it. I want to quote RT for you real fast. And this was actually an article about the Western media. Among American outlets, CNN offered the most dramatic analysis, painting Wagner as a dark mercenary Frankenstein which has turned on its masters. The broadcaster described Prigozhin's attempt at a coup as the most serious threat to his power in all the 23 years he's run the nuclear state. CNN predicted that the chaos in Russia will alter the course of the war in Kiev's favor. Despite this Ukraine counteroffensive incurring up to 13,000 casualties, according to Russian figures, extrapolating on this, CNN speculated that Putin's regime will never go back to its previous heights of control from this moment, and that further turmoil and change is ahead. This kind of nonsensical ranting, with zero basis in fact, is one of the reasons that this is what non-specialists tend to do when faced with sudden shock, sudden events. They tend to get very emotional. They overestimate the significance. The brain seems to want to jump to all kinds of conclusions. But nothing, as always, in the CNN report here was true. Nothing here is true. I don't know if you know this, but Wagner was sanctioned not that long ago, after 2014 beyond, by the U.S. government. I kind of forgot about that, but so the organization itself is not the problem. But knowing full well that no one's going to be able to correct them, knowing full well that no matter how, even if their lies are exposed, that nothing will ever happen to these guys, proving my, you know, argument that media do not exist for information or education. They're there to tell a story and to support an agenda, to create a world that doesn't exist. Sputnik has been great on this. Unfortunately, Sputnik is banned in most of Europe, Western Europe. And they did do, I have a few, the most egregious make-believe stories that the media created. I remember very early on, Putin has fled Moscow. And this came from some Telegram channel with the liberals in Belarus that we've spoken about on this show many times. Of course, not a shred of it is true. There's no evidence, no pictures, no nothing. Strangely, another one, this also was very early on, that the Iranians are going to send Revolutionary Guards to assist Russia. It's kind of very similar to the idea that Russia has gone to China for armor and ammunition, which is hilarious. No one's even close to the number of Russian tanks in the world. This never happened. None of these stories are real. There's a few journalists and very pro-Russian journalists in Iran. Most of Russia, Iran is pro-Russian. And especially since you know, Putin's very popular in that part of the world for stopping the overthrow of Assad in Syria. But that's all these guys said. You know, these Iranian journalists did say, you know, something about, but, and yet American media somehow took that simple point and extrapolated to the point where Revolutionary Guards are going to Russia because Russia so desperately needs assistance. Iran has been very, you know, they're supportive of Russia, of course, but they have no particular opinion over this set of events. It's completely invented. Many of you have heard the whole thing about riots and jails and streets blocked off. They do this kind of nonsense all the time. But RT had the presence of mind to go to the Federal Penitentiary Service. That's all these people ever had to do. It's just kind of, this is what they're supposed to do, you know. The big pretrial facilities, Butyrka and Montovskaya Tishino, the two big pre-trial detention areas. But with a slight increase in police presence, nothing like, you know, shutting down, instituting curfews and all the rest has ever even been talked about, let alone accomplished. The Moscow mayor himself, again, you know, making believe, inventing stories, inventing reality, it's so easy simply to call. Call the Russian embassy. Call the mayor himself. Another story is that Wagner is releasing prisoners because apparently they have control of the prison system. This is spread by, you know, Ukrainian sites. Again, who themselves are just simply making up stuff. That's the point of having these sites. And they claimed the Russian media, quote unquote, as their source for releasing prisoners and training them to join Wagner. There is one other, and it's not on RT, but the Washington Post early on made the claim that Prigozhin's criticism of Putin in his open letter, which is, as far as I know, only in Russian, challenged the narrative of why Russia had to intervene in New Russia in the first place, in eastern Ukraine. Nothing even remotely in his letter, which I've read, hints at that. If anything, he's far more militant about it. So, I mean, what's the mentality for these people? Well, we're going to say that. We're going to say that this Russian patriot says it's all nonsense. And how can anyone possibly get a hold of and who's going to translate the letter? No one's going to do that. University professors won't do that. So they create a story, and they know it's a lie as they're creating it. But to switch gears here just a little bit, we are talking about an era of Russian victory. The U.S. has done for Ukraine what they have never done, not with the Mujahideen, not in support of the Contras. That was banned, and everyone got in trouble for that. And yet the U.S. is involved in depleting their own stocks and this fanatical, monomaniacal attack on Russia. I want to quote Scott Ritter one more time here. And this is more context than anything else. If there was ever an example of how a purpose-built Ukrainian NATO proxy force would perform against the Russian enemy, the 47th Brigade was the ideal case study. However, within days of initiating the attack, the group was close to literally decimated, with more than 10% of the over 100 U.S.-made Bradley infantry fighting vehicles destroyed or abandoned on the field of battle, and hundreds of the brigade 2,000-strong complement dead or wounded. I should note here that he's talking about the failed counteroffensive. He continues, German-made Leopard 2 tanks, mine-clearing vehicles joined the Bradleys as wrecks in the field west of Orykov, having failed to breach the first line of Russian defenses. The reason for this defeat can be boiled down to the role played by KORA, K-O-R-A, all caps, in creating a false sense of confidence on the part of the officers and men of this brigade. Unfortunately, as the Ukrainians and their NATO masters found out, what works in a computer simulation does not automatically equate to battlefield success. Now, I quote that because this is the very context for Prigozhin's little rebellion, little fit. Ritter explains that KORA is a war game simulation. It's developed in Germany. Realistic simulations of battlefield conditions. It's being used in the Grafenwöhr training base. It's a NATO U.S. Army base in Germany. And that's where the 47th Brigade was, from January to May of 2023, was being trained. But this was a training? 47th Brigade was supposed to be the elite brigade of brigades, but their training largely came from this KORA simulation. The simulation had the outline of the battle, the defensive units that Russia has from the 42nd Motorized Rifle Division, and trying to split the 291st Regiment from the 70th Motorized Rifle Regiment. Of course, a computer simulation still has to be programmed. So in the KORA game, the brigade worked out every scenario, all kinds of Russian responses and everything else, trying to find the ideal place to hit. I don't have to tell you that breaching a fortified defensive line is extremely difficult, especially when you don't have any resources. Let me quote Ritter one more time here. And this is extremely important. One would expect that the performance characteristics for the attacking force while capable of being exaggerated, would replicate the reality of the genuine capabilities of the involved forces to a relative degree. To believe otherwise would suggest that the Ukrainians were completely delusional, something their own description of a learning curve during training argues against. One of the critical factors used in programming of Kora, however, is what Kora's designers call behavior agents, used for establishing rules for behavior of the respective units. It is here that the NATO trainers most likely failed their Ukrainian trainees. Here's the upshot. The failure of the Ukrainian counteroffensive comes from these simulations that have to be programmed in by people who themselves are brainwashed. The simulations all had the 70th Regiment, Russian defensive position, poorly trained, chaotic, poorly led, no supplies, and of course, troops ready to rebel. That's what they programmed into these simulations. They clearly believed this was true, and this is when media lies start to cost lives. They created this make-believe projected image of what they think the Russian army is, on the one hand, and an equally powerful delusion, believing that this regiment could, or even has the resources, to punch a hole in anything. Media lies lead to dead Ukrainians, because Americans, the military, actually believe that Russia is falling apart, which is just a projection and a deflection from the fact that their own military is falling apart. But this was Prigozhin's context. Ukrainian military, unfortunately, and you know, because these Ukrainian boys, constant artillery bombardment, no tanks, no competent crews, minefields all over the place that they cannot traverse. Sending these Slavs into the meat grinder is perfectly fine for NATO. It's only a show. If anyone has an offensive, it's going to be Russia. Ukraine has nothing left. They're being ground down all over the place. And the toughest battles were in the south. The Ukrainians haven't reached even the first defense line. The propaganda of retaking Crimea, which all the journalists were writing about like they knew something, they can't even probe. There's nothing left. And these boys, these Ukrainian boys, are being lied to. Ukraine is not an independent state. As I said before, this war was over months ago. People are so dumb that they think that more weapons matters, as if this is the only thing that it needed. Well, they'll send them F-16s, a handful of tanks. No one's going to talk about strategy, fuel, or even the popularity of that administration in Kiev. And there's not going to be a presidential election, as far as I can see so far there. Stoltenberg from NATO, Secretary General, claims that NATO is not a direct combatant, and we know that that is absolutely true. Absolutely false. They are a combatant. Stoltenberg, of course, is told to lie. And you know, NATO itself fully admitted, without the huge transfers of weapons to Kiev, intelligence data from satellites, NATO is well aware that this war would have been over within the first month, couple of months, just like in Georgia. And by saying this, NATO is admitting their direct involvement as a combatant force. As I've already mentioned in the beginning of this, that American PMCs are working with and arming and be part of the training, such as it is, of the Ukrainian military. Stoltenberg says that they're going to supply Kiev no matter what, which is meaningless since their supplies are gone. The Western media will extol the virtues of the Ukrainian army, but there is nothing left. Even media inventions can't work anymore. There can be no NATO membership. There is no Ukraine. To bring someone into NATO, there has to be a unanimous vote. And the clueless media, as always, are used to cover over the failures of liberalism in this case. Kiev is a colonial system. There's no independent element here that can negotiate anything. The constant lies of the Western media is unraveling. We all know this. Now, to bring this to a conclusion, it's unclear off the cuff why Prigozhin did this, but I do have a theory. Well, there's a couple of them, and they're not mutually exclusive. It's over thanks to Lukashenko and the handful of men that were loyal to Prigozhin. I'm not sure why they would be loyal to him, except for money. Were assured, you know, safety. It's very clear. I read his, very unclear. It's very vague. I read his letter, and it's hard to tell what he's talking about. Is he talking about specific generals or Putin himself? He made some vague accusations about interfering with Wagner's operations. No evidence, of course. No real coherence. Putin's response makes a lot of sense, backstabbing, all the rest of it. And at least in official circles, no one's talking about Western interference, but I don't know what else it could possibly be. But Western interference, having identified this man as a weak link, as a mental case, as a Judaic who is very easy to manipulate. The investigation still goes on, despite the fact that they're not going to be prosecuted, at least for now. Some of you may have come across the BlackRock video. That BlackRock, you didn't know he was being taped, talks about how they buy and sell politicians all the time. In fact, they don't really want that much money. Serge Vallée is the guy's name, the BlackRock recruiter. He comes right out and says, BlackRock runs the world. About 7 minutes of this undercover footage. There's several meetings in New York City by some undercover journalist. Now, of course, he's referring to congressmen and judges. But obviously, James O'Keefe is where I found out about this from. It could apply to anybody. If they did it in Iraq, they're doing it here. And yet another attempt to bring chaos to Russia. But what this guy says in terms of buying politicians, judges, military men, whatever, Farley says that it's easier for BlackRock to do things when, quote, people aren't thinking about it. Because BlackRock does not want to be anywhere on the radar, according to him. We all know this. As of now, it's at least a $20 trillion portfolio that BlackRock manages. Incomprehensible numbers. It's larger than the GDP of all the countries on the globe, except the US and China. And this guy says on video, he says, oh, these senators, they're cheap. 10 grand, you could buy one. And, you know, he's saying this like it's, you know, day to day. He says, you could take this huge amount of money and buy people. He says, I work for a company called BlackRock. It's not who the president is of a country. It's who's controlling the wallet of the president, he says. Buy candidates. Senators are cheap. Got 10 grand, you could buy a senator. I'll give you 500K. Right now, and it doesn't matter who wins. They're all in my pocket. Then he says, Ukraine is good for business. You know? Russia blows up Ukraine's grain silos, and the price of wheat is going up. The Ukrainian economy is a wheat market. The price of bread goes up. This is fantastic if you're trading. Volatility creates opportunity for profit. That's a BlackRock recruiter on video saying, confirming what I've been saying since BlackRock really was first mentioned in a public forum. The point of all of this is, I think, the argument that Western intelligence agencies were involved, I think, is just almost impossible to deny. BlackRock is talking about how they buy and sell people and how easy it is. You have an unstable guy who is dying to be considered a tough military man, which he is not. A strategist, even a general. You know, he has these fantasies about himself, despite the fact that he was only in the grocery business. He is not the head of Wagner. He is an executive in Wagner, but he is certainly not the strategic council there runs things. And the fact that this was done, I mentioned all the victories that are happening. The point is, in the midst of this humiliating failure in Ukraine, this happens. The only good news Ukraine's got in a long time. if he was the patriot he says he is, he wouldn't be doing this now, especially given his accusations were not a huge deal and could have been resolved quietly. The fact that Russia won, Wagner won Bakhmut, shows everything he said was nonsense. The fact that he repeated the Western claim that there was no good reason for an invasion, the press said he said that, which isn't true, but he gave the whole Western description of failures and how terrible it was, which is he knows isn't true. That's another piece of evidence that he is using Western talking points. But let me conclude here. I want to give you, I have 9 elements about really what I think is going on with Prigozhin. Number one is the most obvious. He's in the pay of Western powers, directly or indirectly. It's been done before, as the Iraqi example shows. The timing, I'll say again, really dwarfs all other explanations. The New York Times, which, you know, may be making it up, but they say that the U.S. was aware of these plans a few days beforehand. It doesn't count as a coup by any means. But apparently, according to the Times, that the White House knew about it. As I said, number two, Western influence. You could see it using Western talking points. His rhetoric concerns the Western fantasies of Russian defeat. So at least he's dishonest. At most, he's in the pay of Western intelligence. Of course, theory number three, that this is a BlackRock operation. They certainly are more powerful than any of the players here. Number four, that he has political ambition, passing himself off as a warrior, especially since he's not a military man. You know, other guys get the glory, well, all he can do is write checks, thinking that he's a second-rate man, which, by the way, he is. He's not the head of Wagner, at least not militarily. Wagner did have, is relatively popular. Cashing in on that may be one of his many motives. Number five, he needs the attention. He wants the reputation as a tough guy leader. Number six, I personally happen to believe that he has histrionic personality disorder. Let me describe it for you and see how perfectly this matches here. I was initially talking about the so-called March on Moscow. It was a laughable, delusional idea. The fact that he was using, either made or was using fake videos, shows you the level of delusion that he had fallen into. The stunt was pure histrionics, which, by the way, is a mental disorder usually reserved to women. People with HPD, histrionic personality disorder, they have a high desire for attention. They make loud and inappropriate appearances. They exaggerate their behaviors and emotions, and they crave stimulation. Also, they exhibit provocative behaviors, sexually or otherwise, express strong emotions designed to make an impression on others, and are easily influenced by others. This is all modulated by intense and obvious egocentrism, destructive self-indulgence, and this lust for being appreciated and persistent manipulative behavior. I don't know if any description fully encapsulates what happened over the last few days other than that. Tempestuous histrionics is a subtype of this disorder. And part of that is the inability to see one's own position realistically. He thought that he could march on Moscow with a handful of guys. No one's going to notice these fake videos, and he's going to be more popular than Putin and Shoigu and everybody else. Part of the symptom of the histrionic disorder, rather than viewing himself objectively or realistically, he would rather, quote, dramatizing and exaggerating his difficulties. As, of course, he did. Yes, of course, this is a personal psychological issue here. He's dealing with his own personal sense of inferiority. But he may well be playing both sides off against each other, seeing which one will give him the best deal. He is Jewish after all. And I believe he is a classic case. I mean, clearly, down to a T, that he has the, I'm sure he would love this, the feminine disease of histrionic personality disorder. And the West knew that. BlackRock knew that, whoever it was. And they zeroed in on him. And we could thank God that this had really nothing to do with the battlefield. I'm doing this. This is June 25th as I'm recording this. There's been about 20 very minor symbolic Ukrainian attacks that were repulsed today and yesterday. Putin may even go do what Erdogan did after the coup there in 16, something like that, where he purged many ministry, even education, after that actual coup attempt. No, if Putin does it, so much the better. But I'll leave you with the idea that if this is what Kyiv has been reduced to, or the West has been reduced to via Kyiv, then we should thank God for this. You don't do stupid things like this and have these guys do stupid stunts unless you really are totally out of ideas. So ultimately, it was much to do about nothing. I hope I got my point across here. Thank the authors who assisted me with putting this all together, especially in Russian. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.